There are so many dimensions to a great garden, but one that we often don't plan out as much, perhaps, as others, is scent. You know, of course, we all think of flowers as having nice aromas, but some plants have a scented foliage as well, and where and how you use them can make a big difference in how you enjoy your garden. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Mark Dwyer is the landscape manager at the Rotary Gardens in Janesville. And if you've never been there, you'll want to fix that after hearing about it today. He always has some great advice to share, and we're always happy to have him join us. And Mark, great to have you with us.
Well, pleasure to be here, Larry. Thanks for having me.
What's new at the Rotary Gardens?
Well, I tell you, we're at peak summer color right now. It's absolutely beautiful, and with a year that's so different from last year for us, you know, with this adequate precipitation, a little cooler temperatures, our color is very vivid, and I would encourage those that haven't ever visited or haven't visited yet this year to make the trip to Janesville and come enjoy the gardens. I guarantee they won't regret it.
I second that for sure, because I've loved, every time I've been there, I've really enjoyed it, and I've been there at all different times of the year. I want to make sure that we let people know about a family fun day. It's this Sunday at the gardens. What's going on there?
That's correct. Family Fun Day is a program that is running this Sunday. I'm making sure I get the times right, from 1 to 4 p.m. It's family-oriented, and it features our Pollinator's Paradise Garden in our children's garden, talking about the importance of pollination for food and how these insects do so many great things for us. And visitors could get some great ideas on plants to include in their garden to attract butterflies and hummingbirds. And I'll say that garden's looking quite nice as well. We also have a rainbow garden featuring, it's called Planting a Rainbow. This was a book by Lois Ellert, and Lois will actually be on site for a book signing. And this garden was planted to show kids of all ages the importance of colorful vegetables in our diet and how important nutrition is.
Lois is great, by the way. She's a wonderful person.
We're excited to have her, and we want her to see how we've converted her book into a garden space, which includes some vertical garden elements. And right across from that rainbow garden is our giant garden, and that's a very lush tropical space with a very narrow path, so people can walk through and enjoy this lush garden setting. And all sorts of activities, face painting. It's going to be a great day. The weather looks to be nice, and again, from 1 to 4 p.m. This Sunday.
And if you're just off the interstate, for sure, you can go to your website probably as easy as not. We actually have a post, a link on my Facebook page, but it's just Rotary. Is it RotaryCommunityGardens.com?
RotaryBotanicalGardens.org.
RotaryBotanicalGardens.org. Okay,
yes.
Now we have it right.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's great. You know, as we think about our topic today, one of the things that we wanted to zero in on a little bit is scent. You know, we pay a lot of attention to height and bloom and time and color, but we don't always think about scent. How do we incorporate that effectively into our gardens?
Well, and that's a great point, Larry. I think scent is often overlooked. And how often on a spring day, let's say we're in early May, do you catch that scent of lilacs in your taken back years where you remember those in your grandma's yard? And who doesn't love those harbingers of spring, those scents, those early spring scents of not only lilacs but fragrant viburnums and other elements that we're used to? But, you know, our gardens in general can incorporate plants that are not only beautiful but incorporate scent that can be either emitted, meaning fragrant plants that where the blossoms are extremely fragrant. The past 2 years at Rotary Gardens, we had our smelly garden is what we called it, where we had fragrant annuals and perennials, those plants that would emit a fragrance, many of which would actually do it at dusk or in the evening, which makes for a wonderful evening garden for those of us that can't enjoy our gardens till later in the day. But the other way to enjoy scent are those plants that need a tactile engagement, things like basil or lavender. A lot of those plants, by just rubbing the leaves, you enjoy that smell. And, you know, some great examples would be lemon verbena or lemon balm. In our smelly garden, we were showing all our visitors plants that smelled like lemon or vanilla, pine, orange, chocolate. So those scents are out there, and it's something that I think with a little work and a little TLC, these plants can perform for us.
Yeah, and it's great advice. Any other favorites to use, favorite setting plants to use for accents?
Well, right now what we're doing is going through the gardens planting what are called fragrant tube roses, and they're called polyanthes. These are tropical bulbs, and we pot them up in early spring, and as they fill out the pots, we start placing them around the gardens. And what these plants will do, again, called fragrant tube roses, they send up a stalk about 3 to 4 feet with a nice light pink to white flower cluster that will emit the sweetest fragrance you can imagine.
Oh.
And just a couple of these would perfume a backyard. We'll incorporate them in containers or flower beds with the intent of people enjoying a scent, which tends to be stronger in the evening through morning.
Yeah.
You can smell it during the day, but so many of these plants produce wonderful scent, not for humans, but for pollinators. They're trying to attract evening pollinators like moths. There's so many great plants, and in terms of our smelly garden, we have kept an active list of those plants that have done well, and anyone can certainly email me, and I could send a list off very easily.
We were at, my wife and I and daughter were at Epcot last week for a day or two, and the flowers there, they have beds all over the place, of course, and they have some that are designed just for smell. And, oh, man, they're wonderful to walk through. Oh, man. What are some great ornamentals that are edible? Can they really do double duty here in the garden?
Well, there's a lot of plants that we term ornamental edibles, and that term's been around a long time, and essentially it means a plant that looks pretty darn good out in your yard but also has the secondary function, or maybe the primary function, depending on what you're growing it for, of providing food or spice or seasoning. And some great examples would be some of these ornamental hot peppers. You know, these peppers that have wonderful foliage,
yeah,
or very colorful fruit that can be used, in the kitchen. And it's important to mention with hot peppers, they're not mutually exclusive. When you say an ornamental hot pepper, they're still edible. And when you think of our standard hot peppers like, Tabasco or Scotch Bonnet or jalapeno, they're also very ornamental, but are more commonly used in culinary purposes. You know, but back to your question, Larry, the ornamental edibles like not only hot peppers, but Swiss chard, looking real good with colorful stems and foliage.
Yeah.
There's so many herbs, the colorful basils, dark leaf basils, variegated basils. And we have an entire garden space dedicated to ornamental edibles. And I think many visitors see it and think, wow, that looks pretty nice, not knowing that that space is also used for nutrition and vegetables, eggplants. You know, the list goes on and on. And I think as people become more limited in space and maybe are have smaller beds, borders, or containers, using plants with more function or more features makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it does. Mark Dwyer, our guest today, landscape manager at the Rotary Gardens in Janesville, inviting you to join in with your garden question at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. Eric in Oshkosh has been waiting a little bit, so let's go there. Eric, hi. Thank you for waiting.
Hi, great. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question that's a little bit out of season, but I just planted a whole bunch of pines and spruce and junipers along my driveway, and I realized that that's where I throw my snow with the snowblower. And I wonder, do these plants need sunlight during the winter, or do they go dormant?
Great question. So your smaller evergreens, you know, are you more worried about the snow load, or is it an issue of... they do go dormant, but I wouldn't exclude all sunlight. Are you thinking about putting some sort of barrier around them?
Well, what happens is the snow sort of piles up on, you know, in that area when I clear my driveway.
Oh, I see what you're saying. No, they'll be fine buried in snow, but my concern would be, the winter active rodents might find that nice and tasty being under that blanket of snow, and that's when you start to see a lot of girdling on the lower stems and trunks. So I would, don't worry about the snow load covering them unless it's real heavy snow, but you may want to install some chicken wire around the plants themselves to exclude these rodents, because we've had a lot of winter damage when we have heavy snow cover.
I had a friend with a long driveway who did just what you did, Eric, and then got a lot of snow and virtually every one of the trees was girdled up their driveway, which is like 40 trees. So that can happen.
Wow. I hadn't thought of that. I will definitely do something before winter rolls around.
Yeah, rabbits will love it. Now, there are a lot of different things that would eat on it.
All right, thanks for the info.
Yeah, thanks, Eric, for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Facebook question from Sandra, who says, the bottom leaves of my squash, my Hubbard squash, have totally wilted after I pruned off the very bottom leaves because they were too big. Half the leaves on the plant are wilted now. What might have caused that?
Boy, that could be a couple things. I mean, whether it's an insect doing some damage, I would encourage her to take a look at all the stems and see if there's any entry holes or any issue of insect damage, which would quickly wilt, you know, a longer portion of stem. Well, the other concern is if you're in there doing some snipping and pruning back, if there was any mechanical or physical damage done to a stem by her, that might be a causal problem as well. The local extension agent might be a good contact with some photos to start with, but it's tough to, you know, tough to surmise over the phone. But closer inspection is definitely warranted.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. Talking today with Mark Dwyer, landscape manager at the Rotary Gardens in Janesville, I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer, on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking with Mark Dwyer of the Rotary Gardens in Janesville today on this edition of Garden Talk. Great to have you listening in, and join in, 1-800-642-1234. Roger in Lone Rock up next. Roger,
hi.
Thanks for calling.
Yep, thanks for taking my call. Glad to hear you're talking about ornamental edibles, and I wanted to just throw out myself, being one who likes peppers, thinks they're beautiful, but does not like heat. There are also a lot of ornamental peppers that are not hot, and one great source with a great website, great catalog, is Tomato Grower Supply. They have roughly 30 ornamental peppers that are not hot.
Wow. Are you familiar with that one, Mark?
Yes, that's a great catalog. We order from them as well. And to that point, you know, a couple years ago, we grew 232 varieties of hot peppers. And the intent there was to grow all the ornamentals, all the culinary ones from very little heat all the way to extreme heat. And I can't take the heat myself, so I do enjoy those that look beautiful with low heat. There's a real nice one called Chili, which is sharp. But these heat units are registered in what are called Scoville heat units. And something like jalapeno might be 5,000 heat units. Scotch bonnet is 300,000. The hottest in the world right now, called Trinidad Scorpion, is 1,500,000, which is enough to, you know, tear your throat out. But, you know, again, for the culinary use, I think people should select those that are appropriate. And that again, going back to the original comment, that is a great catalog for sure.
Yeah. Thanks, Roger. Appreciate it very much. And Linda in Island Lake, Illinois, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I really appreciate it. I have I'm not sure exactly which one, but it's a pear tree in the front of my house where it's at least 20 years old. And last year with the drought, it suffered, and I watered it. And this year, it's losing a lot of its leaves. They're turning brown, and there's like yellow, black, brown spots on them. So I didn't know if there's anything I can do to water or Miracle-Grow or anything.
What do you think, Mark?
Well, I think what I would do immediately is get some samples to Extension and have Brian Huddleston and his team take a look at those. We just had some pear samples that tested positive for fire blight, which is something that affects crab apples and other woody ornamentals. And it's been quite prevalent this year, and some of the symptoms include not only the browning of leaves, but you'll start to see twig death. You know, the twigs that lead up to those browning leaves are white, are crispy and dry. So, again, tough to know over the phone, but I would cut some samples right away and get them for diagnostics.
You can go to the plant. Yeah, it's the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the University of Wisconsin. And if you have access to a computer, you could just go online. And they prefer that you mail things early in the week.
Okay.
So that it doesn't sit in, you know, a hot mailbox for a couple of days. So if it's mailed on Monday or even Sunday night, you know, if you've got the post office nearby, that'd be great.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And yeah. I love your station. I listen to Wisconsin more than Illinois. So.
Thanks, Linda. And be sure when you get that sample, make sure that you've got some of the good part of the leaf or the branch as well as some of the diseased part. So I think they usually like to have a little of both, don't they, Mark?
Yes, for sure. And I apologize, I didn't catch it. She was from Illinois, but Illinois Extension should be able to do the same thing for her.
Elizabeth in Elroy, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Appreciate your call.
Say, last winter, I've got these two bushes. They were given to me, and they're called like a burning bush.
Yeah.
And last winter, when the snow got up a little high, something had eaten the what they could reach. Well, when they blossomed this year, it was all green on the bottom, and then there was a bare spot in the middle, and then it was green on top. And I'm just wondering if I might be able to prune that back in the fall to the green down towards the bottom, and if they would come back.
Hmm.
Well, the short answer to your question is yes, absolutely. And
okay.
Important to mention that burning bushes are extremely tasty. And when that gentleman called earlier about the evergreens being nibbled under the snow line, we made that comment. Burning bushes here at our garden, we are constantly protecting because they're very soft barked. And if they're girdled and that cambium layer is compromised, you'll get sporadic death or the entire death of the plant. We've mm-hmm. taken large burning bushes and we've cut them back severely, extremely far back. It's important to mention you're not going to see it spring back immediately to, obviously, its original size, but it'll take 2 or 3 years, but it'll fill out again. But keep in mind that winter protection. You'll have to do it for the next couple of years because you don't want to take any steps backwards after you get this regrowth.
Well, it's pretty high. I mean, it's like it's like 4 or 5 foot high.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, a foot down, it's all bare, and then, like, 2 or 3 feet, then it's all green again. So if I could just clip off those dead ones, I mean the dead part in the middle there, it should be okay, right?
Yeah, yes. Just cut down into that really nice solid layer of green. And next spring okay. It's going to look a little stubby and you'll see some little branchlets coming out. But, you know, by 2015, you'll never know you cut it. So give it a whirl. I think you'll have some success.
All righty. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Elizabeth, for calling. Appreciate it very much. Again, you can join in with your questions or comments as we talk late summer gardening and themed gardens. We're talking a little bit about putting some really great aromas in your garden as well. How's your garden done this year? Anything out of the ordinary? Do you plant for scent as well as for color? What are some of your favorites in the scent area? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or go to my Facebook page. You can post there at The Larry Mueller Show. And if you have some nice photos, garden-type photos, flowers or veggies, we'd love to see that as well. We had a Facebook question from Sandra, who actually... I'm going to pass on that question for just a minute because we have a comment on nasturtiums that are gorgeous flowers and easy to grow, and they are edible.
They're a great ornamental edible. The leaves and flowers are edible. They're typically used as a garnish. The leaves have a peppery taste to them, but nasturtium leaves have been used in sandwiches and other appetizers. And with the blooms being edible, it's something that we've included in every ornamental edible garden we've planted here. And it's a great rambling plant, fills in nicely. There's variegated or marbled foliage types and the full gamut of blooms. So, you know, nasturtiums have been used for hundreds and thousands of years in gardens, and that edibility to me is just an added benefit of an already great plant.
Janet in Madison, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi, guys. I have a question and then a comment on a nice-smelling plant.
Yeah.
My question is, I'm wondering if deadheading hibiscus and moonflowers makes any difference in blooming. Does it increase the amount of blooms like it does for petunias? And then my comment was the sweet autumn clematis is a very nice fragrant plant. I have it next to my patio, so you can enjoy it there. And it's so easy to grow. It grows really fast, too.
Oh, sweet autumn clematis.
Yeah, that clematis is a great one, and it's important to mention to the listeners that it typically starts blooming in September, pretty solid through October. Now, depending where you are in the state, that'll vary, but it's a late-season bloomer, but I would agree it's as sweet as anything you could smell. And it's the type of clematis you can cut to the ground late in fall or early spring, and it regrows very vigorously. The comment about deadheading, moonflower, I'm not so sure there's any value in doing any sort of deadheading to. The hibiscus, we do no deadheading of hibiscus. We actually, I guess I'd have to ask what type of hibiscus you have. Do you know what type it is?
I can actually go grab the little stake that's next to it.
Yeah, I wonder if it's is it an interior, like a floral type hibiscus, or is it outside?
It's outside, and it's, hibiscus mochutus.
Oh, Mashudos, yes.
I was close.
I don't mean to correct you. But that is a perennial hibiscus that dies to the ground each year. Nice dinner plate size blooms. No, there's no value in deadheading those.
Uh-huh. Okay,
no, you won't get more blooms. And usually you'll get quite a few, and that's a plant that many people grow and they think it's dead until it emerges late in the season. Sometimes not coming out of the ground until June. But then July into August, sometimes September, you get the great blossoms. But I don't see the value in deadheading that at all, because ultimately all that growth is going to die back to the ground. And I don't see that it would have time to form new flower buds that would be encouraged by deadheading. So
okay.
I wouldn't bother.
Okay. You were exactly right. It was so late to turn green and emerge. I was really concerned that it hadn't made it through the winter, but they both did, and they look beautiful right now. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Janet, for calling. Sarah in Middleton, hello.
Hello. My question for you is that I have peonies that are covered in what appears to be powdery mildew that I've never seen before on them, and I'm not sure whether I should treat them or leave them alone or cut them back now or how to save them.
Well, powdery mildew this time of year is running rampant here at our gardens as well, and it's really a result of the weather. There's these cool nights, a lot of moisture, and so powdery mildew, our peony collection is almost entirely covered with mildew. I certainly wouldn't cut them back yet. You want to let them start to yellow, which frequently happens in September. Then you can cut them back, but you can do one of two things. You can either wait. And when you cut back all that foliage, dispose of it. Make sure you collect every piece and get rid of it. Don't let any pieces of the foliage stay on the ground because you run the risk of reinfection of mildew next year. So you want a clean site. You can treat the mildew with a fungicide, and that will clear it up. However, in my mind, it's quite a cosmetic issue. And here at the gardens, we minimize chemical use. So what we're going to do with our peonies is probably in mid-September, we're going to cut them all down and do that sanitation process and clean them all up and hope for some drier, warmer weather next year. And again, I think this year is just real conducive to really thick visual mildews.
Yep.
Okay. Now, typically, I leave them up through the winter and cut them back in the spring, but it sounds like this year I ought to clean it up in the fall and make sure everything's tidy before winter, correct?
Right. Good point. You could certainly leave cleanup till spring, but in this case, I'd do it this fall, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Very good. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Sarah. Thank you for calling. And Pat in Madison, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I have a question about flowering shrubs. Should I prune them in the fall or should I wait until spring? Now, this is I'm trying to think of what they all are. They're flowering shrubs. One is the bridal wreaths and a couple are with white flowers. What are they called?
Are they blooming right now?
No. They're not blooming now.
Mm-hmm.
None of them are.
Mm-hmm.
But they bloomed out. They bloomed in the spring.
Well, it's a crapshoot depending on the type of plant. And I'll tell you, with bridal wreath spirea, be wary. You can cut them back and they'll regenerate, but they frequently won't bloom for a couple of years. Most Japanese spirea, the kind of meatballs we see all over the landscape, the Japanese style ones with the pink flowers, we cut all ours back every winter down to the ground and we get new growth. But we've learned by experience that the bridal wreaths are a different type of spirea that, again, if your intent is to do some cut back for size, that's okay, but you'll lose the flowers for next year. But knowing if a plant or a flowering shrub blooms on old wood or new wood is pretty important. An example would be like the panicled hydrangeas that are blooming now and look great. Those will also bloom. They'll bloom on both old and new wood, so there's no issue with doing some cutting back over the winter. But there are plants like lilacs that if you prune at the wrong time, like now, you'll lose those flowers. So there's not a wrong time to prune any type of shrub if you're not worried about losing the blooms. You know, preferably we do winter pruning, but the concern is if you want to avoid losing those blooms on those that only bloom on old wood. And hopefully that makes sense. You really have to know the plant and ask some pointed questions at the garden centers and to knowledgeable people about when the best time to prune that specific shrub would be.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, if I went on the website and remembered the name of the shrub, would that answer my question, if I should be pruning them now or in the spring? I mean, they grew like wild this summer. I suppose it was because of all the rain or whatever, but... I have to prune them back because they're rubbing against the house.
Yeah. What I would recommend is if you do a internet search and you type in when to prune and then insert the name, you'll get some advice. Now, of course, don't believe everything on the internet, but
that's
I would
true.
Offer, feel free to email me that information and I could give you some advice as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and the email would be?
If you get on our Rotary Gardens website that Larry mentioned earlier, or even internet search for Rotary Gardens, all my contact information is on that website.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right. Great. Thank you very much for calling, Pat. Appreciate it. And Karen in Elgin, Illinois, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello. How are you?
Great. Appreciate your call.
Thank you. I was calling because I have three poinsettias, and they were all doing fine until my one little one, I think I overwatered it, and the leaves all curled up. So I took it out of the pot, put it in new pot, new soil. It still didn't get better. This was all this week. And then I just took it out of that pot, cleaned off the roots, and put it in water. But I don't want it to die, so I don't know what to do about the little poinsettia.
That's a tough one, and I will say with poinsettias, when people have them and get them in the Christmas time or the holiday season, and they try to carry them over as houseplants, they're a little persnickety about lighting, and they despise overwatering. And in many cases, some of the overwatering is because customers have left the foil lining on the pot, meaning those pots aren't draining out.
Right.
Was it a drainage issue, do you think?
Oh, yeah, I think that was the problem. I took that off. The other two are doing fine. I just don't want to see this one die. And I don't know what to do, whether to put it in sand or just leave it in the water or put it outside in the sun or get new dirt.
I think you've done almost everything you can. I would, with your repotting regime, I would take that, your repotted plant, and put it where the other ones are that are doing halfway decently. But if you have an area garden center or nursery that grows poinsettias, I would encourage you to talk to them and mention your problems, because they've dealt with all sorts of things like this. And I have to say, they're not my strong suit, but I understand you want to definitely keep this little guy going. So make a couple phone calls, and maybe you'll get some better advice.
Yeah. Good luck, Karen. Thank you very much for calling. We have Susan in Cottage Grove next. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I have a lot of acorn squash plants, and they have overgrown the space I allocated for them. I want to prune them back, but I'm afraid to do that because I don't want to give insects an entry point. Is there advice on whether to do that and how?
Well, and your concern is warranted because if as you start making some cuts, which seem like a good idea, even judicious cuts to control the size, that does create an opening that may invite some visitors. Boy, you know, that's really a tough one because by making those cuts, there's a lot of chemicals you can use to deter, you know, to deter insects and some other undesirables. But, you know, if you're growing these for food production, depending on how you feel about chemicals, that can be a little tricky. I wonder, is there a way you can coil or pull those vines in, or is there anything else you can do to preserve the current size of that in a smaller space?
Well, I can let them climb all over each other. That's basically what they're doing now. I wondered about if that actually cuts down the sunlight that gets down to some of the lower leaves. And maybe I'll just leave well enough alone.
You know, that would be my advice. You know, we've had some issues here with cucumbers and various squashes that have overgrown space. And we find after we've tried to re-guide them or cut them back, we end up creating more damage, and we regret it. So if you can live with it, I would encourage that.
That's what I'll do.
All right. Thanks, Sue.
Thanks.
Appreciate it very much. Just as an aside, I have some tomatoes growing. We're doing some straw bale gardening. So we have some tomatoes growing in straw bales just as an experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And I, when Sue mentioned cutting the lower leaves, I cut the lower leaves off because they were just growing together a little bit too much, and I wanted to get those lower leaves out of there. So I, you know, there would be less chance of disease issues.
Mm-hmm.
And oh my goodness, those plants just took off.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my goodness, I couldn't believe how quickly they grew, and added a foot.
Oh, for sure. Well, in tomatoes, that thinning is a little easier. The problem with those squash is those thick, hollow stems are an issue. But, yeah, we do the same thing with the tomatoes here. And the grafted tomatoes we're trying new this year have done extremely well, although we're hoping for some warmer weather to get these tomatoes ripening here.
Yeah, that's a problem that we have at our home, too. We have all these tomatoes growing on all these different tomato plants and not very many red ones.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Richard in Manitowoc, it's your turn next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, good morning to you. What a beautiful day.
It is.
I have a question about Creeping Charlie. Is it considered a broadleaf plant?
That's... If the question is, would it respond to a broadleaf
chemical treatment and leave the grass alive?
No. And Creeping Charlie is it's a tough thing to deal with, and I hate to tell you how we deal with it because there's a lot of myths and stories on how to eradicate it without damaging surrounding plants, and some of those treatments I feel are questionable. So in areas of the gardens here where we have Creeping Charlie, we use a broad spectrum herbicide. Essentially, it'll kill everything, and we scrape everything out, and we reseed the area. To my knowledge, there's not a selective chemical or weed control that'll just selectively take Creeping Charlie out of turf. And if someone knows of one, you know, call Larry and let us know. But it's a stubborn plant, and it's tough to get rid of without being severe. And that's what we're doing here at the garden.
You can take a look at, if you go to your garden center and take a look at those, if you want to use a chemical, those that will list for Creeping Charlie. And then probably the best time is to wait till right after the first frost this fall.
Mm-hmm.
And then I do the application if you're going to apply an herbicide.
Mm-hmm.
And usually that weakens them. They don't die right away, but a lot of times you get them to winter kill.
Otherwise, can I hire you guys to come and take it out by hand?
You know, my daughter and I, Emily and I, have spent many fun hours in our lawn and some of the garden area just picking Creeping Charlie. And it is amazing in an hour how much you can
get a pail full of it.
More than a pail. I'll tell you what, My daughter's pretty fast. She can, she'd have a couple of pails going.
Well, okay. Thank you, guys.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. I really have fun. It's kind of fun just to sit there and pull that miserable stuff out. thanks again, Richard. You might want to join in, too, if you have a call question at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page. I haven't gotten any photos yet. Garden photos. You can do that on the Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk as we visit with Mark Dwyer. Mark is the landscape manager at the Rotary Gardens in Janesville. Comes by every so often to talk with us. He does a great job, and I always appreciate having him along. You have a question for him. I hope you'll call at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. We had Carl in LaCrosse has a comment. Carl, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I was listening in the gentleman just called about dealing with Creeping Charlie. I've had tons of experience killing this stuff because I used to have a yard that was full of it. The one chemical that I found works is anything with a, you can get a little bit of a higher concentration of triclopyr in it.
Yeah.
And to kind of echo your comment, Larry, it usually takes two applications, I've found, at least around where I am. You want to do it in the fall so it takes it down into its roots over the winter and weakens it. And then if it's still alive in the spring, right when it starts to flower, hit it again with it, and it'll usually be gone within a month after that.
Yeah.
That was my comment.
Thank you very much. That's very good recommendation, Carl. Appreciate it. And we have, well, let's go to Paul. Paul in Little Suamico. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good morning. I was listening to the comments about the Creeping Charlie, too. I was in a Stein's Garden Center one day just waiting to be waited on, and the clerk was actually talking with another person about Creeping Charlie, and they have a herbicide brand there called Weed Beater, and she claims that will get rid of it because I've tried the Bayer brand and Ortho, and neither one got rid of it permanently, and she claims this stuff will.
I bet you it's got some triclopyr in it.
Yeah, that's possible. Then I also had a question. I have a Globe Arborvita. I actually planted it as a privacy screen all the way across the front of my yard a number of years ago. It was only supposed to get like 4 to 6 feet around, and this stuff is like 10 feet around and almost probably close to 10 feet high.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if there's it's actually getting too big on the outside. I was just wondering if there's a way I can trim that back without killing it, if it'll come back.
Right. And you know, the Globe Arborvitae is a beautiful plant, and it's a good example of a plant that's promoted as at a certain height and in reality just never stops growing. And there's many plants that fall into that. You certainly could downsize it or shear it. The trick is, though, you don't want to get below green growth, meaning if you look in the interior of those Globe Arborvitaes, you'll see essentially brown. So that outer, say, foot or 24 inches of green, you can prune into that where new growth will regenerate. But the idea of taking an 8 to 10 foot globe arborvitae and making it down to a 3 or 4 footers is impossible.
No.
It just wouldn't regenerate. It might send out a couple sprouts, but again, your best bet is to shear into the green, as we say, and if that's a size you can live with, that should work.
Right, because that's the height I'm not worried about. It's just it's sticking out so far on either side. No, it's,
mm-hmm.
I can't even get in there to cut the grass anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You may have to, if you really want to cut it back, you may have to cut it off right at the stem and start all over again.
I lose all my privacy, and it's building up too much right here.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. Doris in Bonduelle has a greatly overgrown Mugo pine. She's wondering, is it possible to start new little Mugo pines from that greatly overgrown big one?
Is that if her intent is to make cuttings? I'm not sure. Is her intent to make? Oh, I see. I'm not sure about pine cuttings. How well those?
I'm not either.
You know, I tell you, the Mughal pines are, and they're a beautiful plant, don't get me wrong. They also fall into the category of the previous caller's arborvitae, because I've seen Mughal pines that are 20 foot tall and 20 foot wide. I mean, they get large, but they're very inexpensive. And I'm not encouraging someone to spend money in lieu of, you know, propagating it, but I don't know enough about the best way of taking tip cuttings or what you would do with a Mughal.
Okay.
They would need more advice from someone else, I think.
A Facebook question from Annette, the Syringa reticulata, Japanese lilac. That tree, they have that on their property. It was healthy. Recently, the leaves has curled under and are drying up. Hasn't been anything unusual in the way of stress aside from last year's drought.
Mm.
But the last year's drought could be the answer there.
Could be a factor. Mm. And again, I think a sample would be in order because with these various things going around, or verticillium wilt might be a problem, but a sample would be the best bet because it's hard to tell by the description if the entire tree is getting that or just sporadic. Our lilacs have had some foliage issues this year, but nothing quite that severe, so I think a sample's in order.
Scott in Genoa, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi there. If you guys ever get a really good Creeping Charlie question, yeah, let us all know. Or a really good Creeping Charlie answer, that'd be great. I've got a mature hawthorn tree, and next to it has been growing a walnut tree. And as the walnut tree has been growing over the years, it's now approximately 10 years old, the hawthorn tree is doing increasingly worse. And now it has leaves on it, maybe about two-thirds of the leaves. The top is starting to kind of be bare. And so just wondering if I cut down the walnut tree, will the hawthorn tree possibly do better?
Boy, don't write this down, but I'm going to throw some speculation at you on that. And that, I believe the hawthorns fall into the Rosaceae family, which and the rose family has some issues with walnut toxicity. So as that walnut has grown and the roots have gone under your hawthorn, the roots in particular emit juglone, which is an inhibitor. It's great for getting rid of neighbors. And while there's many things that can grow under walnuts, my guess is that's exactly the problem with your hawthorn. So by removing the walnut, of course, you'd get more light. And
sure.
The important thing to mention, though, is it takes almost 2 years after the removal of a hawthorn, or excuse me, of a walnut for those roots to not have that effect.
Sure.
So I would speculate that the removal of the walnut, if that's what you want to do, would improve the health of the hawthorn. But tough to say that there's not something else going on with the hawthorn as well, and they're also prone to a lot of diseases, too. But,
okay.
You know, speculation. And,
yep.
And maybe some samples of sent off on the hawthorn to see if there's anything else going on. But I think that walnut's going to become a thug and out-compete that hawthorn.
Yep.
Okay. I kind of wondered about that.
There you go. Thanks for calling, Scott. Appreciate it. And we have Kathy in Milwaukee next. Kathy, hello.
Hello. As you know, I'm in Milwaukee, and I have a tulip poplar that is about 30 years old, I think. It's huge and beautiful, and it has about a 13-foot offshoot coming off of a root at the base of the trunk. Is there any way I can save this offshoot and use it to be another tree? Or is it endangering the beautiful tree that I already have?
Well, a 13-foot offshoot, what's the diameter of the trunk as it comes out of the ground then? Is it a couple inches or?
Yes, maybe 3 inches.
Okay. Well, and the real question is, does that offshoot, you know, what sort of root mass is extended off that offshoot? Or is it just a root sucker?
Nothing.
Yeah.
It's a root.
Yeah, I think you'd have a hard time transplanting it, even if you had a small tree spade come in and just sort of, you know, dice down there and remove that. I don't believe there'd be enough additional roots to support that. I mean, it's worth a try, but you'd want to get as much soil and additional roots as possible. But the time to make a move like that would probably be in spring.
Yep. Something to think about, Kathy. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And Charles in Cumberland. Hi.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Your guest talked about tuberoses, brought back memories. When we lived in Alabama, my mom had about 10 or 15 varieties, and they would bloom all different times during the summer. My question is, where would I get those, and how would I winter them over?
Great question. Now, the fragrant tube roses, and tube rose spelled tube rose, you know, right together, they're offered as a bulb frequently from mail order catalogs. Certainly patronize your local garden centers and see if they carry them. It's important to mention, though, the time from planting to bloom for us is quite extensive. So we order a couple hundred through the mail, and there's a couple mail order sources like Brent and Becky's Bulbs. There's a source called Van Engelen Bulbs. And you certainly could get online and find these bulbs. And when they come in, they're the size of a daffodil bulb. But we pot them up in April. We put them in 6-inch pots, and they send up foliage in the pots through June. And ultimately, we place them out in the gardens. They haven't bloomed for us yet. So again, they're a late season bloom. And in terms of storage, we treat them like you would a canna or a dahlia. As soon as frost knocks back the foliage and the stem, we dig them up, clean them off, and we store them at 55 degrees in the dark. So they're dormant. So if you've ever stored summer bulbs, again, cannas or dahlias, it's the exact same treatment, and you can perpetuate fragrant tube roses for decades that way.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. We have a question from Jerry in Beaver Dam next. Hi, Jerry.
Hello.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
I got trouble with blight in the garden for tomatoes and potatoes, and it's like I think it's a fungus in the ground that I don't know. And then I planted in a different spot this year, and then it seems to do better. But on my old spot, plants are kind of withering.
Yeah. Well, and you know, blight, we've had some horrible issues with late blight in particular. And here in our areas, we're starting to see some blight issues on tomatoes and some other vegetables.
Yeah.
Boy, I think, again, maybe a soil sample, or it's tough to say what's going on. And I'm not sure what the window is of opportunity for replanting an area where you had blighted plant material and when you can replant it. And if you're using a different vegetable or a different plant, the blight doesn't affect all plants equally, and some not at all. So it's really dependent on what specifically happened with your vegetables that previous year.
Okay.
So I'm talking in circles here, but it's really tough to say what's going on in your situation.
So you say soil sample and go from there, then, I take it.
I think so. And take some pictures of what was happening with your previous crops, but take some photos of the plants that are starting to struggle. And that I think that would help also in identifying the problem.
Yeah, because like the summer squash is getting, the leaves are starting to turn yellow and
Right. Mm-hmm. And it's tough to say, again, if that's a blight issue. There's been so many weird things this year with such a cool year. We're seeing just a lot of different symptoms we haven't seen for a long time since it's been so dry and hot for us.
Absolutely. Jerry, thank you very much for calling. I appreciate it. We have an email from Sharon in Wabasha, who planted hydrangeas. This is their second summer, prune in spring, but I'm disappointed the plants are only about a foot and a half high. They have beautiful pink blossoms, but I know nothing about gardening, so I'm surprised they are alive at all. They're in full sun most of the day. Would fertilizer help? And what time of the year would you fertilize?
Well, it depends on the variety, and based on her description of pink flowers, it's a macrophylla type hydrangea. Some bloom on old and new wood, but her question, I think, is more about its health and vigor. Hydrangeas for us they're water hogs. They really need a lot of water, and our best hydrangeas, particularly that type, are in moist, rich soils. And we rarely fertilize, but when we do, we would typically do a fertilizer in June, and then one in early September. Although, if you have decent soil, that's not necessary. But I think knowing the name of that specific variety and going to the garden center and getting some help. Now, there are dwarf hydrangeas as well. I mean, she certainly could have purchased a smaller variety. But, again, I think it's an issue of watering and soil.
Bill in Middleton has a few fruits on his tomatoes, but a lot of flowers that haven't set fruit are on those plants, too. Plants are very green and healthy. Is there any hope for more tomatoes?
Well, that's Mother Nature will let us know. I'm looking out the window of my office here, and I'm seeing the same thing on some of our tomatoes. There is some fruit set, but I'm seeing hundreds and hundreds of blossoms. So what we really need is a turn in this weather. And I can't speak for the rest of the state, but for us, it's just been darn cold. I mean, it felt like October these last couple of mornings. Next week looks to be warmer. Let's just hope we have a warm rest of August and a nice warm beginning into September. And I think this gentleman will see more fruiting.
Yeah, I would agree. Matthew in Dunn County, we'll get to you and we'll get to all of our callers as we move along here. We have been lucky to have with us and are lucky to have with us Mark Dwyer. Mark is the landscape manager at the Rotary Gardens in Janesville. They have the Family Fun Day this Sunday at the gardens from 1 to 4. At the Rotary Gardens in Janesville. A lot of fun for the entire family, and so I really wanted to mention that again and put a plug in for that. Go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We've got a link to the Rotary Gardens website, and you'll be able to get all of the information about the face painting and everything else that's going to be going on there. Mark Dwyer is landscape manager at the Rotary Gardens in Janesville. I'm Larry Mueller on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Gardening, such a great pastime. It can be very calming out there to be working in the yard. And sometimes maybe you might feel it's a little therapeutic as well to yank out some of those weeds. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk. My guest today is Mark Dwyer. Mark is the landscape manager at the Rotary Gardens in Janesville. Lots of good information to share with you about how to take care of your plants in the late summer, and even thinking about what we might want to plant for next year. Mark, thank you again for taking time to be with us today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure.
We have many callers online to visit with you, and Matthew in Dunn County has been waiting a while, so I want to go to him. Matthew, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hey, thanks, Larry and Mark. I have probably about a 10-foot tall, about 2.5 inches at the base, and it's an aromatic eastern red cedar, and it's being kind of choked out between a plum and some pines that are about 30 feet tall. And I was wondering if I could transplant it, and if I was to do that, where I should do it and what time of year.
Great question. Is your intent to hand dig it yourself or get a tree spade in there?
I was going to dig it out myself, I think. It's 10 feet. I think I can move it, you know, get it up on a tarp and save as much of that root ball as possible.
Right. And that's doable. I think, you know, your best timing would be, I would recommend late September or early October. And if you can't do it then, I would do it in April, like mid-April. So, you know, again, you want to get as much of the root mass as you can and try to keep the soil intact around the roots. And that's the challenge,
right.
You know, get a couple friends involved, and as you're digging that up and lifting it, try to wrap that root ball and keep it damp, do it on an overcast day, plant it at the same level. In fact, plant it a little bit higher because it'll settle into the hole. You know, have your hole all measured and ready, and then just water the heck out of it until the ground freezes, if you do it this fall.
Do I want, like, a full light area? Do I want to, like, kind of group it in with some other trees? What should I go about in that area?
You can't go wrong with full sun for a cedar, would do okay with part sun. So if you put it in a spot where it would get pretty good morning light and or pretty good afternoon light, it would be fine. But if you do have a full sun spot and the tree that you're going to move is you know, pretty symmetrical right now, I would get it in the sun.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Good luck, Matthew. Thank you very much for calling. And let's turn to Terry in Franklin. Hi, Terry.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling in regarding to a balloon plant. You know, when you deadhead and it's sort of gone limp and changed color and faded, then can you save that and replant it somewhere else? You know, like reseeding?
Your balloon flower, you're seeing, your question is, can you save the seed and replant elsewhere?
Right, right.
Sure, sure you can. You know, and,
oh, you
and,
can.
Oh, yes, and balloon flowers, they're not the easiest plant to divide. That's something you could do in spring, you know, with a spade. You could take chunks of the plant, including roots, of course, and moving chunks of it. The thing that I always also mention about balloon flower for the taller varieties is it's not a bad idea, as they're emerging in spring, to do a little cutback on them, so they're not quite so flat.
I have a little one, and it seems like I always lose it because it goes underground, and then I thought, oh, my goodness, I lost it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know,
yeah.
So it never shows up. It goes all the way down to the ground.
Mm. Well, and if you're able to collect viable seed, you certainly could grow it. And again, it's a pretty tough plant, so hopefully you'll have success with that.
Yeah, good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And you can join in, too, if I have an open line or two at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. Claudia in Colfax emailed us wondering what are good flowers to plant that will flower in fall. My flower garden looks rather dull now because my fall mums have not bloomed yet and my other flowers are done.
Mm. Well, that's a great question. And when you think of progression of bloom, many of our gardens are very heavy on spring flowers, and we segue into summer. Now, late in the season, depending on her zone of hardiness, I'll toss a couple ideas out. But some of our latest blooming plants here include plants like monkshood. There's many late-blooming monkshoods. Toad lily, or Tricertis, is mm-hmm. the Latin name for toad yeah. lilies. They'd be good in the southern portion of the state here. There's a lot of perennial daisy-type flowers. Perennial sunflowers, and if you get perennial sunflowers, get clumping forms because there's many that will run all over the place. And if you're examining your landscape now, you're seeing a lot of those daisy-type flowers that extend interest well into the season. There's also a perennial called turtlehead that will bloom from now almost till frost, and turtlehead likes wetter conditions and runs in the pink and white colors. And there's so many options, and I think it's a great comment to ask that because so many of us start quitting gardening when we get into September. We start finishing up, and it's a great season not only to make sure you have extended color, whether that's your perennials or you're bringing in mums or other plants. Don't forget your late-blooming asters. But fall's a great time to plant bulbs as well, you know, looking forward till spring.
Yep, absolutely. Our daylilies, we have quite a nice daylily bed, and we planted, my wife had, you know, different maturity dates in mind, but they all seemed to mature at the same time anyway. Which is kind of too bad.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Lori in Richfield, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I've got a maple tree. It's been in the ground over 20 years. Looks perfectly healthy. Leaves came out just fine in the spring, but all season it has been dropping leaves profusely, perfectly healthy looking leaves. And the tree is not like bare or anything. It's not defoliating. And if you looked at the tree, it would look fine. But when you look at the ground and the amount of leaves that have fallen, it just seems like an astronomical amount. Mm-hmm. Is there something going on? Or is this just a... Because of the drought last year?
Stress issue, probably.
Well, it could be a stress issue, but the fact that there are nice, clean, healthy leaves that are falling, here's something to consider. Do you have active squirrel family up in that maple?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, of course.
The squirrels?
Squirrels, we got squirrels all over the place, yeah.
Yeah. You know, we in the gardens here, it wasn't that long ago, we were finding all these ash leaves that look great. We know ashes have some issues, but the leaves were fine. And it turned out it was squirrels just nibbling, and they were gathering some nesting material, but in essence, they were dropping more than they were saving. And it was totally healthy foliage, and we were, you know, confused for a week or so until we saw what was going on. Tough to say. That's the first I've heard of something like that. And the fact that the rest of the tree looks healthy and symmetrical, hopefully it's just a stress thing and or the squirrel problem. The fact that your foliage isn't showing any other signs of
of marking or of fungus or anything like that, I guess I wouldn't worry so much.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Rachel in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. My question is, my neighbors have the most beautiful Sarvisberry bush, and I'm really wanting to be able to sprout some seeds and grow my own, but I was wondering if I need to separate those seeds out from the fruit, what time of year I should do that, and how it works to start a tree from seed.
Wow, well, Sarvisberries are great, by the way, and I think
I love them. My son loves them too.
Oh, absolutely, and you're lucky to eat them. If you can eat them before the birds get to them, they're a special treat. I'm not familiar with how to process the berries. Of course, the seed is in the interior. Your best time for seeding out a Sarvisberry would be spring. So if you collect the fruit now and get it cleaned off and save that seed, get it dry, I would seed out a whole bunch of small containers next spring and nurse those along. But I would get online or get some additional help, because I'm not sure if the seed itself needs to have some sort of stratification or scarification if you have to actually scrape the seed. And it may actually need to sit outside and experience dormancy, meaning you leave that seed outside through the winter and then plant it in spring. So make a long story short, I'd get a little more info on it, but you certainly could grow your own Sarvisberries.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. And Joya in Fitchburg.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yes,
I have a question for, when is the best time to divide the mums and the peonies?
Ah, good question. The best time to divide mums is in spring. So when they're just emerging from the ground and they're less than 3 inches tall, that's the time to get in there and make your divisions. Move them, keep them well watered. The best time to divide peonies is very late in the season. So heading into late September and October as the plants are going dormant. And if you've ever divided a peony or if you've never divided one, it's an exercise. It's exercise is what it is.
Yeah.
It's some serious digging and dividing.
Yes.
And but you would certainly want to do that in fall.
Why, is there a special procedure for dividing the peonies?
Not so much. You know, the problem is they have a very woody root mass. So when you're digging that up and you expose it, what you're going to start to see are some eyes, some growing points already formed for next year. So in dividing the peonies, you want to make sure that you make clean cuts. You need nice sanitary tools that are sharp enough to deal with.
And you need sharp.
Yeah, and you want to make sure that your peony divisions have a couple, 3 to 5 of those eyes, preferably, and then get them moved and get them watered in. And, the peonies are a great plant, but you would never want to divide them at any other time except late summer into October.
Okay, I have another quick question about the poinsettia. I have them out already in the yard. They're potted in the out. Is it the time to bring them in now and do the 12-hour, shift?
Right. I'm not sure when that starts, and you're right, you have to give them total darkness for, I think, 15 hours or some sort of rotation involved. I would ask it at a garden center, again, that grows those and get the timing down, because that's vital for the best coloration, of course.
So you are not sure about the timing. Okay, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot for calling. And we have Zoe and Amory to deal with here. Hi, Zoe.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a problem with real unsightly neighbors on either side of my yard, and I've planted arborvitae on both sides, and they've grown quite well, but they reached a lot higher height than I expected, and my husband has had to cut them back a couple of times because in these heavy snowfalls, they get so heavy with snow, they've bent over and broken.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering what I can replace them with. I need something that's evergreen all year long and dense from about, ground level up.
Mm-hmm.
And all the things I can think of either can't tolerate the shade, because I have a fairly shady yard, and the fence line runs north to south, so whatever I plant along that row is going to partially shade, you know, the other.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering if you have any suggestions. I know there's a kind of a flat-leafed yew, Y-E-W, but I think they burn in the I'm worried they burn in the winter sun exposure. I'm also kind of tempted to plant bamboo. I've never experimented with bamboo at all. But what are your suggestions?
Well, I'd stay away from yews because they'll never get the height that you need. And you're right about winter burning for many species and varieties. Bamboo is tricky. I know near Milwaukee they can grow some bamboo in some warmer parts of the state, but most of the running bamboo you'd want to stay away from.
Yeah.
And yes, it's evergreen, but in our winters it shatters and loses most of its leaves. So even if you could grow it, it wouldn't be an effective screen. But what the arborvitae, unfortunately, with some of your shading, you're really pigeonholed into arborvitae, again, being a tough plant that will take some of that shade. And the winters have been tough on arborvitae. There's no doubt about it. Something to consider is depending on your zone of hardiness, they are now offering what are called western arborvitae. Now, we typically plant eastern arborvitae. Western arborvitae has the benefit of extremely fast growth, and our deer haven't quite formed the palate for it yet. So here at the gardens, we're growing western arborvitae because of deer damage and some other issues, and they're doing very well. And I'd hate to say plant the same thing, but ultimately your conditions really limit your plant selection for an evergreen screen.
How tall do they get?
They can get extremely tall. Ultimately, they just don't stop growing so easily, and you can keep them at 8 foot, 10 foot, 15 foot, even 20 foot or taller. And there are some different varieties. They're easy to shear. And we're seeing, again, very minimal deer damage on these. And they've done pretty well with snow loads because most of the varieties we have tend to have a dominant central stem or leader. So they're not as prone as to splay open like many of our other multi-stemmed arborvitae. So if your local nursery carries western arborvitae, that might be a nice replacement for your conditions.
Okay, how well do the eastern arborvitae tolerate we basically had to cut ours in half, and I'm wondering if they're gonna live. We cut that dominant apical meristem quite significantly. Mm-hmm. Can they tolerate a lot of trimming?
Yes, they can, and even stubbing them off like that. What you'll see now is a lot of kind of fingerling-type growth or feathery growth because you don't have the dominant leader, which is fine, but you'll have to maintain that height. You'll have to shear them to look visually nice, but they'll respond to that. They won't die from that at all.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Zoe, for calling. And let's see. Let's turn to Marianne in Waukesha next. Hi, Marianne.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Last year I bought some potted strawberries that were supposed to be everbearing, and they did have strawberries all year, but they got eaten off by chipmunks, so I decided to use them as hanging pots. And they had some berries on, and then they stopped bearing and started sending out runners. If I keep taking the runners off, will they eventually get more berries? And what type of fertilizer should I use to so that they'll make more berries?
Well, a lot of that depends on the variety. So are you're treating strawberries that are in the hanging basket right now? Is that right?
I put them in pots and hanging baskets so the chipmunks wouldn't eat all the berries off.
Right.
The first year they did have berries quite a long time, up until fall.
Mm-hmm.
But not this year.
Yeah. Well, with our strawberries, we typically do a balanced fertilizer in spring, like a 12-12-12. And to answer your question about the runners, I'm not sure by removing runners you're going to end up getting additional flowering and fruiting. It certainly won't hurt, but it sounds like you've got a lot of competition for the berries, which is part of the problem. Tough to say without knowing the variety
And I guess a concern would be if you thought your strawberries were ever-bearing and they're not, maybe you got the wrong variety. Maybe it's like a June-bearing variety where you only get one wave of fruit. I would call your local extension agent, to be honest, with some more strawberry questions. Or if you have a local strawberry farm, that might be a good place to start as well.
Yeah, good luck. Thank you for calling. We had a Facebook comment from Carol, and we're getting back to our scent, aroma topic that we started the show with today. Carol says, as a B&B owner, I use many flowers as garnishes on our plates. I know many of the flowers that are edible, but can you point me to the nutrition information of some of them? We have a landscape labyrinth with some of our edible flowers, plus we serve hibiscus, bee balm, daylilies, and so forth. And this is the Hillcrest Hideaway on Facebook, the Hillcrest Hideaway. So anyway, Carol's got that question.
Yeah, I've researched and I've done many topics on edible flowers, and some things to keep in mind. Number one, don't ever assume a garnish is edible. You know, it's sometimes they are for decoration and not meant to be edible. But there are so many edible flowers, and I've not found a lot of nutrition information on them. I mean, the internet may be a good resource, but you know, Larry, you mentioned with her comment, many of the edible flowers, the hibiscus, the daylily, the flowers of borage, the flowers of dill, fennel, basil, those are also edible. And again, the flavors will vary, but going to back to nutrition information, I don't know of a good source for that. And let's keep in mind, edibility doesn't necessarily mean flavorful to everyone. So
yeah,
that's a subjective sort of thing. But there are entire books written on edible flowers, and I would encourage anyone interested to go that route.
Peggy in Superior, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. Excuse me. I would like to move a bleeding heart plant and divide it. When would be the best time to do that?
Actually, your bleeding hearts are going dormant now. They're getting their yellowing stems and leaves. Your best time to divide a bleeding heart is between now and October. And they also have a somewhat rooty, woody root mass. So similar to my comments on peony earlier, if I were moving or dividing bleeding heart here at the gardens, I would wait until probably mid-September, make sure I know where the plant is, because by that time, much of the foliage has died back. Dig it up and also make clean cuts and divisions and replant it. And they are none the wiser. They'll pop right back up in spring, and they should be fine. So short answer to your question is I would do it in about a month.
Judith says her bleeding heart looks like somebody sat on it.
Yeah, and they do here as well. That's just going dormant. And as soon as they get yellowish and with broken stems and floppy, you can cut them back. They don't mind it.
Peggy, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Mark, this has been great. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Glad to be here.
Mark Dwyer is landscape manager at the Rotary Gardens in Janesville. Don't forget Family Fun Day this Sunday at the Rotary Gardens in Janesville from 1 to 4. Lots of fun for the entire family. He does a great job, and we'll look forward to having him back again. And we always look forward to our guests of physical therapy. And Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne-Brody will be with us on Monday. You ever get Charley horses? They'll explain why we get Charley horses and what to do when one hits. I got one in my hand the other day, and it was really, really painful. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.